Blog Talk Radio.
Here of the Story Blender, of course, hosted by author Stephen James. Stephen's got a great show today. Professional storyteller and actor Dolores Hydock will be his guest on the show today. But before we jump into that, we have to tell you about some other things here on Suspense Radio, and that is that Janet Cole, she writes what she knows, the world of big law, lawyers, and clients. Her new book is The Mystery, The Smell of Money. In the book, she pairs disgruntled law partner with a contract killer having a midlife crisis. They have a common client, an old woman whose ruthlessness includes her need to kill opponents, and they meet when the killer's next target is the lawyer's daughter. Find it on Amazon or on your bookstore. Please visit coleslawwithak.com. Also, Kensington Books, Daniel Palmer, Constant Fear, Kevin O'Brien, The Last Victim, Lisa Jackson, Most Likely to Die, and Mary Burton, Vulnerable, are all here on the Kensington Book Trail. Visit kensingtonbooks.com for more information. Of course, they are sponsoring us throughout the year on every show. Also, 2015 New Mexico winner for Best Book, Robert Cadera, is now in his second installment with Get Lost. You can check that out on Amazon also. Betty Jean Craig has a new book out called Fairfield's Auction. It's the latest book in her Witherstone mystery series. You can visit Betty Jean Craig, that's Craig with an E, .com for more information. Also, Crooked Lane Books wants you to know if you're ready for a thrill, because check out great books, including Leslie Karst and Anna Carlisle, by visiting CrookedLaneBooks.com. Impossible to Put Down, says best-selling author Louise Duncan, about Annabelle Lee. It's the latest book by Mike Napa. Visit Coffee, C-O-F-F-E-Y, and HillSeries.com for more information. And finally, Jeffrey Deaver and Lee Child agree that Hostage Taker by Stephanie Pintoff is a winner. Suspense Magazine also agreed with them by putting Hostage Taker on the list for one of the best books of 2015. So make sure you go right now and check that out at AmazonAlso.com. So we are going to now turn over to none other than Mr. James with his show tonight, The Story Blender, with special guest, professional storyteller and actor, Dolores Hydock. So, Stephen, take it away.
Welcome to The Story Blender. I'm Stephen James, and this is where great storytellers share the secrets of great storytelling. And today I'm welcoming Travis Thrasher as my co-host. Travis and I met a number of years ago, and we kind of really hit it off. It was neat to meet someone who's a kindred spirit in storytelling and in writing, and he's one of the hardest working authors that I know. He's written more than 30 books, including movie novelizations. He writes books faster than I read them. So, Travis, thanks for coming in to be a guest today.
Sure. You forgot to mention that we met in prison, but that's a whole other story that we won't get into.
But, I still remember my daughter was going up to school in Chicago, and
yeah.
we met, I think, for breakfast somewhere, and one of the outskirts of Chicago. And I always get all of them mixed up because there's like Oak Park, Oak Forest, Forest
oh,
Park,
sure.
Oak Forest, Forest Oak. You know, he's like, could you not have named one Bob or something?
Yeah.
You know, they're all, you know, exactly the same kind of iterations of different types of trees. So.
Yeah,
anyway,
sprawling
it's
suburbs.
Great to have you. So, sprawling.
Yeah,
suburbs.
Thanks for having me.
And our guest today is an old friend of mine from many years ago. We met probably maybe 20 years ago. Dolores Hydock has produced numerous award-winning audio performances and has appeared at national and international storytelling festivals and conferences all across North America. She has a master's degree in storytelling, and over the last 5 years, she's become one of the most popular presenters at the International Storytelling Festival in Jonesboro, Tennessee. Dolores is also an actress who's written and performed many acclaimed one-woman shows and plays throughout the South, specifically in her hometown of Birmingham, Alabama. And Dolores, it's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thanks so much, Stephen. I appreciate the chance to be talking with you and Travis today.
Yeah. First of all, congrats on all of your storytelling success and your one-woman shows over the last couple decades. I remember when we met in the storytelling program over at East Tennessee State University, even then I could just tell that you had an amazing talent for performing, developing stories, and it's exciting to see where all of that has led.
Well, you know what's funny, Stephen, is that when all those many, many, many years ago when we were in school together, starting out in that program, I came from an acting background, a performing background, and the situation in my life at the time with full-time job and other things, I just wasn't able to be in any plays, do any kind of theater performing, and storytelling kind of cropped up as a way to still use words and still communicate ideas in something outside of theater. And I really went to that storytelling program hoping to get some kind of affirmation or confirmation that it was okay to do that, that was an okay way to come in sort of through the back door into storytelling. Even though I live in Birmingham, Alabama, I grew up in Pennsylvania, where the storytelling tradition is very different than it is in the Southeast. You know, I've been in Alabama now 40 years, and here in the South there's this fabulous storytelling tradition. I call it sitting on the porch rocking and lying.
Rocking and lying.
You know, it's that wonderful, easy, you know, I remember the Christmas granddaddy came home with that green Buick, and off you go, and it's this wonderful kind of stream of consciousness sort of thing. But when I was growing up near Philadelphia, if somebody was going to tell you a story, it was going to be a traditional folk tale. You know, that's the story. If somebody said you were a storyteller, that's what you did. You told the stories, the classic stories of life wisdom that came with so many of, you know, my grandparents and people of that generation through Ellis Island from the old world. And so that's what storytelling was. And so it was a whole different thing when I got to Johnson City, Tennessee, and East Tennessee State, and people had all these different ideas about what storytelling was. And I'm just so grateful that I've been, number one, allowed to stay in the South because I love living here, and number two, that I've been allowed to tell stories my way, which tends to be a more theatrical kind of way than some other storytellers do, and to sort of blend my theater background into the storytelling and to have that be okay. I feel very, very fortunate that I've been sort of given that latitude to do that.
Yeah, no, that's excellent because, you know, probably when we met, there was sort of this, this impression within the storytelling world, people who would go to conferences and festivals, and for those who aren't familiar with it, a lot of storytelling festivals had cropped up, you know, over the years around the country, and it was almost like this prejudice against the idea of performance. Like, I would remember people saying, I'm not a performer, I'm a storyteller.
Yeah,
I'm thinking,
what?
They didn't like the idea of getting up like a stage performance, but it was like rocking and lying. But I think, you know, at least from my perspective, a lot of that has changed, and the community really has welcomed in a variety of different types of stories and storytelling and storytellers, and I think that's super healthy.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I think it's interesting when there's the big International Storytelling Festival in Jonesboro. Every October, they always bring in international tellers as well. And it's fascinating to me that the great tellers from Ireland, England, Scotland, Germany, these people tell folk tales. They do not tell personal stories. That's still not their definition of storytelling. And I don't know if you remember, there was someone else in our class, Stephen, that lived in Alaska. And I remember him talking about the Native American group people who lived there and around him, and he said their storytelling didn't have a beginning, middle, and end. It sort of like picked up somewhere and then stopped somewhere, and there was a whole different kind of, you know, tradition there. So I think it is fascinating that, you know, Asian cultures, African cultures, European, and then the different parts of the United States have different ways of telling a story, and I think that's so important that people don't feel shut out from the process just because they do it differently. I mean, I think nowadays, I don't know, you both said you have daughters, and I'm not, I don't know what age they are, but to me, most people now under the age of 30 are telling their stories on blogs, in video, you know, on Vine in 6 seconds. They're still telling their stories, but they're doing it a very different way, and that's still a legitimate way for human beings to communicate the message, which I think all stories have the same message, which is you're not alone. There's other people out here who have experienced something like you've experienced, and we're all in this together. And so I think it's fascinating to watch how many different ways there are to tell a story.
Yeah. Dolores, did you know, like, at a young age that this was something you both wanted to do and that you were talented at doing?
Well, there's two parts to that answer. One is I've got my first blue ribbon in storytelling at the age of 5. There was there was a summertime program in the little town where I grew up, and they had all kinds of events for kids. And one of the things they did was have a storytelling contest. And you were in your age group, and so I remember being in the 6 and under age group, and you get up and you tell your little story. You know, you stand there with your hands, you know, clasped in front of you so you're not waving around. And, of course, I was the only kid in my age group, so it was easy to win the blue ribbon. But, you know, it was encouraging, and I knew very, very early on that I love words. I love the power of words. And I didn't know it was going to be storytelling. I didn't know if it was going to be acting or what it was going to be. I just know my entire life. I can't even remember a time I couldn't read. I could already read by the time I was in first grade because my parents loved to read. There were always books around our house. And I'm sure my mom taught me to read by the time I was 4 years old. And so I always just loved the power of words. You know, I mean, both of you are writers. And so you take 26 letters, the same 26 letters, and you put them in every possible kind of combination, and you can inspire, educate, entertain, make somebody mad, provoke, you know, argue, persuade. You can do so many things just with words, and I just have always, always, always loved that. And so, again, I just feel so blessed, so fortunate that I've been able to do that for a living, because it's always been something that's just been a passion of mine. I love the alchemy of it. You know, you stand up, and there's people sitting there saying, okay, I'm game, I'll listen, and this conversation begins, and, you know, Brigadoon happens, you know, castles get built and communities get built and families appear and people appear, and it's all in your imagination just by the artful use of words. And I love being on either end of that conversation.
Yeah. I'm curious too, you know, talking about, like, with all the stories that you tell and you know, you're all these different courageous, clever, strong women. Do you prefer telling stories about fictitious characters or, you know, historical figures versus sharing your own personal stories?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I really do 3 kinds of stories, and I love them all, but for different reasons. And probably my least favorite are the personal stories, least favorite to tell. Just because, again, that's not what I grew up with, and that is so, as I feel so much like I'm stepping out without a net when I do that. But people seem to really love, even especially here in Alabama, they love the personal story. And so I've tried to get more comfortable with that, and I'm always struggling to get better at doing that and figuring out how do you tell a personal story that isn't about you. You know, I think that's the real secret of the personal story is that, well, he was an Episcopalian priest who was just a fabulous preacher. And one time he said, a good story holds up a picture frame. A great story holds up a mirror.
Wow.
And so to me, you know, the key to a personal story is that I'm not asking you to watch my vacation slides from last summer. Something about what I'm trying to show you is going to hold up a mirror, and what you're going to see is yourself someplace in that story. So that's, to me, always the challenge of a personal story. Then there's like I do these medieval stories where or literary stories where there's fabulous literature. Oh, my gosh, it's incredible literature that almost nobody is reading anymore, but they are magnificent stories. I mean, some maybe medieval or from the Renaissance, but then also just things like O. Henry. I mean, you want to talk about a storyteller, but the language was a little different, the pacing was a little different, but if I can take that story and present it in the way that, just as he would have done 100 years ago when he was writing in a way that people talked. And so if I can do it in a way that people talk and say, look at this great story, these great characters, great plot, I feel like I'm opening up something to somebody that they might have missed, you know, and that maybe it inspires somebody to say, I'm going to take out the collected works of O. Henry and just read a couple of those and read one other than Gift of the Magi for a change. So there's the literary stories. And then the third, and the ones I maybe like to do the best, are the stories of real people. You know, like you mentioned the strong women. I do one called Starch in Their Petticoats, True Stories of Strong Women Who Settled the West. And there's five people in that story. It's about an hour long. And there's a pioneer and a homesteader, a professional gambler, a mail-order bride, and an actress of the 1850s who makes Lady Gaga look shy. I mean,
Lady Gaga look shy.
These were real people. And who's reading their stories? Who knows anything about them? I'm not talking about Annie Oakley. I'm not talking about, you know, any Calamity Jane, anybody you ever would have heard of, because people know about them. But there's thousands of other people whose stories are astonishing and whose lives were brave and full of energy and passion, and nobody knows anything about them. So when I'm, you know, sort of starting to prepare, you know, thinking about what's my next story, I think, okay, do I want to talk about the summer I was 11 in Reading, Pennsylvania? Boring. Or do I want to talk about, you know, this professional gambler, Poker Alice, you know, who made $125,000 one night in an all-night poker game in New Mexico? I'd rather talk about her.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you mentioned, Travis, earlier that you work on some memoirs now. And some of the most exciting things I've gotten to work on is when I get to tell somebody else's story because I have a microphone and they don't. There's a piece I put together, it's called In Her Own Fashion, about a woman who was 95 years old when I started to interview her. And we were together for 18 months. She died at the age of 97.
Wow.
And for 18 months, I'd get with her once a week, and just she would talk, and I would record, and out of that came this about 90-minute show where I go back and forth between being me, Dolores, Yankee interviewer, and her, this quintessential Southern, elegant, sassy, ambitious, smart, funny woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she's someone, she was the head of fashion at the department store, you know, at Marshall Field's kind of department store in Chicago, but in Birmingham it would be Loveman's department store. And she was the head of fashion in the 1950s when, you know, a department store fashion, what that was really something.
Yeah.
But you know, and at first I thought this was all going to be about her and her career, and we just started talking. It turns out this woman was born in 1913. She saw the 20th century. And
wow.
And could talk about it. And so getting to bring her story to life and share that story with people, it, you know, I love getting to tell the story of people who are not famous, who will never be famous,
mm-hmm.
but whose lives mattered to somebody. 'Cause I think that's where most of us live. You know, most of us are not going to be on the cover of Time. Most of us are not going to, you know, stand the world on its ear or win the Nobel Peace Prize. Most of us just try to get through our lives with our dignity intact. And if I guess I want to celebrate that in people and sort of communicate, if I can, to anybody who's listening, that's worth something too. You don't have to be famous to have made a difference with your life, or to have your life have meant something. So I love getting to do those stories of not very famous people. And in fact, tomorrow morning I'm leaving at 5 o'clock in the morning, going to New York City to go to the performing arts branch of the New York Public Library there at Lincoln Center, because I'm researching a woman named Irene Castle, who was a dancer in the 19-teens. And there again, it's someone who, you know, had her moment of fame, but nobody really remembers her anymore. But but it's a fascinating life. And I guess I just feel like she's almost a fictional character to people now who don't know anything about her. I mean, you could say, hey, you're making that up. But I really think holding up someone else's life and just sort of celebrating that is something I just really, really love to do. So I'm lucky I get to do all three of those kinds of things.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The personal, the literary, and the sort of historical story. And they're very different. And I'm doing so much talking here.
No, this is exactly what we were hoping you would do, because...
There's something that's sort of a corollary to that to me, and that is part of the reason I get to do all these different kinds of stories is because a whole lot of my performing work is right here in Birmingham, Alabama. And sometimes I encounter other storytellers, you know, when we're at festivals out of town and, you know, all these the people who make their living traveling around. And they say, most of your work is at home? You sleep in your own bed at night? And the answer to that is yes. And I've been so, so fortunate to have people here in Birmingham, in this community, sort of maybe a 50-mile radius, people who, again, have been willing to have a very wide-open view of what storytelling is, and who have let me do a variety of stuff. They've let me take storytelling and integrate it into an everyday event, rather than having performance storytelling only be something that you would encounter if you went to a festival. I mean, the festivals are great and they're fun to do, and the audiences love kind of getting away and entering this kind of other world for a full weekend. But right here at home, you know, there's a county library system that has a hugely active adult programming section. And so just for instance, last year they were doing a big, they got a big grant about consumer finance, about helping people understand finance. And I had the head of that program come and say, would you put together an hour of stories about money to kick this off?
Oh, that's good.
And so I went to like 12 libraries around the county telling stories about money just as a way to start the conversation, you know. Or, you know, last week there was a nonprofit that was having a big dinner for, you know, a thank you for their volunteers. Would you come and do a story? You know, that's sort of a motivational kind of story. You know, I do things for women's retreats, spiritual retreats. I do things. There's a lot of Lenten programs that I'm doing right now at various churches. There's a big a library that has me come in and do a performance once a year, a 90-minute. They don't care what it is, just so it's new. They just want new
stories.
But it's an evening of stories. You come. There's a little buffet, and we sit down. We have 90 minutes of stories. So it's so great that the museum, that's the other one, the Museum of Art here has had me four times come in, and when they have a special exhibit, put together an hour about Norman Rockwell, something we didn't know about him, you know, that will just complement the, you know, don't be an art historian, but use stories to help us see this in a different way. So what a fabulous challenge to get to do. And as a result, it's sort of like I'm guessing you guys, I mean, Stephen, I know you write the, you know, some detective stories where you have the same detective. Is that correct? You've got...
I do have one of my main series is about an FBI agent, and I think I've done 10 books in that, you know, 10
Okay, it's the same agent,
series.
Right?
Yeah, Yeah.
And Travis, do you have a similar kind of thing where you have a character or a setting that gets, you know, that's sort of a series?
Yeah, I've done a couple series. Most of them have been pretty different, and kind of like, you know, picking up on what you were saying. Most of mine has been in the fiction world, but I love going and thinking and writing about different characters, and that's again why the whole telling somebody else's story and trying to figure out how to make it interesting to the reader, and you know, what's captivating about them, even if they're a celebrity, what's the most interesting part, you know, in my eyes.
Yeah.
So it really is. It I've not only learned a lot telling other people's stories, but also I've just found that I really love it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I get the point I was trying to get to is that if you do something for the same audience, and you know, if your readers know you and they say, oh, great, there's a new Travis Thrasher book out, there's sort of a brand, I would guess, but people have some idea of what they're going to get if they read a Stephen James book, if they read a Travis Thrasher book. Is that, would you say that's true?
Yeah, it is, and it's interesting too. You know, as I've talked to more and more people, they're like, "Well, what's your brand? What's your brand?" I'm like, "I don't really know, because I've done, you know, a variety of different things. I know,
yeah.
Travis has done too." And like, if you identify too closely, you kind of paint yourself into a corner, I think.
Right.
And people are like,
right.
"Well, what?" But
yeah.
That's one of the things I like about you, Dolores, is you're almost your own brand within the storytelling world. Is you know, the variety that you do tends to be something that we don't see that much in a lot of other speakers and actresses.
Well, and part of what's sort of allowed me to do that is having this community here around me that lets me do that. That says, okay, Dolores is going to do 90 minutes of stories, you know, in May. I don't know. It could be medieval. It could be a historical person. It could. I mean, this coming show is going to. I'm calling it Close Encounters of the Storytelling Kind, and it's about people I've met, famous people I've met through storytelling, like Dr. Ruth, or Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, or the president of Lodge Cast Iron Company. You know, these are just people I met because of storytelling. But because people give me that latitude, they say, well, if you're doing the story, I don't know, you know, it might be a literary story or it might be a personal story, but I know there's going to be a certain, number one, amount of wordiness
yeah.
in it. But there's a sort of a, I mean, they know they're not going to get knockdown, knee-slapping humor, because that's just not me. They're not going to get tall tales. That's not what I do. They're not going to get the sort of aw shucks, sort of, you know, there's just certain things about the kinds of stories I tell that they know going into it.
Yeah.
And what that does is give you a lot of freedom then to branch out into different topics, because you know people will sort of go along with you. They will trust you.
Yeah,
you know,
they
you
trust
don't
trust.
Have to.
Yeah.
You don't have to earn that. I mean, you do have to earn it every time. But starting out, you have they sort of give you the benefit of the doubt before you begin, and then that's yours to lose. You know, by messing up. But
well, you know, one thing I think in for listeners out there who, you know, a lot of them are writers and storytellers, obviously, but you know, this whole talk of brand, and that's a huge, huge subject that I won't get into. But,
yeah.
Dolores, I think, you know, what you're saying, and this is something I've seen in my career, because I really have tried to not stay in any type of genre or brand. And it has been to my detriment in some ways. But, you know, for the way things are changing in the publishing world, in Hollywood, in just media and all that stuff, it tends to be that, listen, if you're good at telling a story, you know, it's starting to not matter as much as it did maybe 20 years ago. You know, you prove yourself, and that's what you're saying. You know, you people just know when you're telling a story, it's going to be good. It's going to be entertaining. So you're able to then take yourself or take a real person or something like that, because, you know, they're saying she's going to do a great job. And I think working on your craft. For me, I'm constantly trying to become a better writer. So whether it's, you know, a character I've used, or if it's, you know, some celebrity I'm trying to write a book for, which is completely different, mm-hmm. I'm still trying to bring everything I can to the table, just like all of us, you know, the storytellers. And again, I know
sure.
my strengths are not verbally telling a story, as I mentioned. It's more getting in, trying to figure out the words to put on the page. But I just think that's fascinating because, you know, again, I think a lot of, you know, how are the ways people can tell stories? And you're an example of, okay, there are a lot of different ways you can tell them, and you don't have to necessarily be boxed in or branded. Stephen, like you said, Dolores is a brand herself because people know she's able to do that. So I applaud
yeah,
that.
I know it's been frustrating. And if you've been working with, you know, in screenplays or Hollywood, I mean, it's got to be so frustrating when people want to put you in a box and say, okay, this person tells folk tales, period, end of story,
right.
done.
Yep.
You know, this person tells, you know, writes thrillers, period, end of story. Maybe you want to write a cookbook, you know, but because that's sort of, you know, the slot that you've been put into, and I think in so many cases for marketing purposes, it happens that you know, the people who are hiring you want to say, well, what slot do you fit in? You know,
yeah.
And I know that can feel really, really stultifying, you know, to any creative person who might want to branch out in lots of other ways, and it's almost like, oh my gosh, please don't let me get too successful in a genre I really don't want to live in because I'm going to be
yeah.
stuck there the rest of my career.
Yeah.
You know, but
now
you,
when you're
you
talking,
feel,
go ahead. Oh,
go ahead. I was just going to say, do you feel like, you know, the whole the self-publishing, the way the, you know, the internet has opened so much up where you know, you're sort of not just in the studio system anymore. I mean, people have a lot more latitude to try to get their own story out there. I mean, do you feel like that has freed up, you know, writers to be able to try different things and not just be stuck with, oh, well, my agent says I got to write another one just like this one? Do you feel like that has sort of opened some things up for people?
Well, I mean, my experience might be different than Travis's, but for me, it's actually become harder because there are so many self-published books coming out
yes.
every day. I mean, the last time I think I checked, it was like 5,000 per day.
Oh my gosh!
Books coming out, and a lot of them are just because the reality is a lot of them aren't that well done because people haven't really edited and gone through the process as much as maybe they could have proofread it. And so, you know, to me, I don't care how a book's published, if it's self-published or through a, you know, I told people, I don't care if you read my book on a piece of paper, a chalkboard, a sidewalk, a computer screen, as long as I can make a living telling you, you know, the
yeah.
stories. But that's been unfortunate in the sense that there used to be a slush pile, really, at publishers where someone would read through and say, this really isn't ready. Oh, this is, so let's look at this. And there was a big pile they called the slush pile. Well, now that slush pile is all self-published. It's
yeah.
all available on Amazon. It's all competing with the other stuff. So it's hard to get heard. I mean, the question is, if everyone has a megaphone, how do you get heard
yeah.
above the noise? And
yeah. Yeah.
So that's kind of what's happening when everyone has, you know, to self-publish or to do a YouTube video, you know. And,
mm-hmm.
Well, I tell people that I completely agree with you, Stephen, and the thing I'm saying over and over to people, you know, people will meet me, and I've been a full-time writer 8.5 years, and I'm very fortunate to do that. And they're like, man, that's awesome, fascinating. I said, well, it's amazing, and it's also terrifying when you have a family and 3 children and all that. But I say it's never been easier to create today than today. You know, you can make a film on your phone. You can go and record an album or two, you know, in your hotel room. You can write a book and publish it, and it doesn't cost any money. One of the most difficult things is actually trying to sell that piece that you just
that product,
made.
Yeah.
And not that, I mean, I believe in art. We create, we do these things and we create them because it's like we have to. That's, you know, I didn't want to become a writer because I thought I'd make money. But there is that aspect of business, and, you know, that's why I continue to be like, you know, like look at the music industry. Everybody streams music, and a lot of times it's free. And so how in the world, there's never been more music to choose from, but, you know, that influx of 5,000 books published each day, Stephen and I, you know, we know it's even more difficult to then get recognized, and, you know, and it's hard for publishers. It's just, it's a fascinating time, I think, we live in, because there's so many different ways to tell stories, which means people's time, you know, people don't have enough time because they're watching YouTube videos, you know?
Right. Right. You know, and the, that same phenomenon happens for storytellers, story performers, the people in, you know, any kind of a live performing art. It's the same thing. I mean, people have a choice of, you know, getting out in the rain at 7:30 on a Thursday night, or
yeah.
they can stay at home and watch, you know, Netflix
yes.
on their 54-inch screen, you know, or they can be being creative themselves. They're down in their, you know, in their back office, writing a blog that they're hoping is going to make them the next pioneer woman. So they're, you know, you're right. Then that same phenomenon, that same thing that has opened up so many possibilities, has also made it harder and harder to get anybody's notice or time, or, you know, or and certainly physical presence. I mean, in my case, as a live performer, I am asking somebody to come and be a live audience.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm asking them to get out of their house. I cannot deliver this, you know, through Amazon Prime. You got to get out and get, you know, get someplace in order to participate in this. And so I'm always so grateful when anybody shows up, or that there are people willing to do that, because it asks a lot of the audience to participate that way. Somebody said, I forget who it was, they said, attention is the currency of the information age. I think that is so true. That's what we're all, is eyeballs, you know, everyone, you know, how many eyeballs, you know, how many hits did you get? How many likes have you got? It's attention that we're all scrambling for. I mean, I'm competing with you, you know, stay home and read Travis's new book. No, let's go out and hear Dolores tonight, you know? I mean, we're all competing for such a limited amount of attention. And then beyond that, I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm also asking, I don't just want your attention, I want your emotional participation.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I'm not just asking you to come, you know, see a ball game. Well, of course, no, in Alabama, that's an emotional participation.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but I mean, I really am asking for your very real visceral presence. So it asks a lot of an audience member.
But I think that's really why we come to stories, you know. Whether it's written stories or told or movie or film, we want that emotional connection. And, you know, once in a while I'll meet someone and they'll say, what do you do? I say, well, I write, you know, novels. And they'll say, oh, I don't really read much fiction. I read nonfiction. And it's almost said in a condescending way, like, I don't have time to, you know,
for the silly stuff, like
fiction,
yeah,
but I'm going to read
yeah.
biographies and so on. And
yeah.
But my question is, you know, when do you feel the deepest? When do you cry at home when you're reading a nonfiction self-help book, or at the movies? Mm-hmm. Or when, you know, when do you laugh the most? Is it, you know, sitting there? So my question is really like, well, if you don't read fiction, what are you afraid of feeling?
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of turn the question around to him, like, well, you're avoiding the deepest parts of being human, the deepest emotions that we have, the grief and the pain, the empathy, the love, the tears, the laughter, all of those things you're cutting out of your life by just reading, you know, stated or whatever the term is, you know, nonfiction and so on like this. Now, not to say nonfiction can't be moving, but very often, a lot of, you know, the deepest connection we make is fictional. It's really interesting that we go to movies, we go to shows, we go to plays, and we go to novels to experience the things that we avoid in real life.
Yeah.
The grief,
yeah.
the tension, what's going to happen, the suspense. And that's one of the things I love about your work, Dolores, is you have kind of one foot in two worlds, the acting world and the storytelling world. And I know some people want to draw lines between them and say you're this person's an actor, this person's a storyteller or whatever because of the fourth wall, or there's no fourth wall or all of this. But but I like that you're able to kind of bridge that gap. And I know one of the seminars that you teach is on acting skills that can help train storytellers. And I wondered if you could just elaborate a couple of those ideas that you've picked up over the years through the acting world that can really benefit storytellers or speakers, presenters, anyone who's, you know, up maybe giving a speech or any of those things. We're all engaged in this idea of storytelling.
Sure, sure. I mean, and I think there's so, wow, there's so many places where those things overlap, and I've encountered so many storytellers who are terrified. Don't make me, I don't want to be an actor. Don't make me an actor, you know. And that's not at all the objective of that. But some of the things, for instance, the whole idea of using your space, being aware of your space. Now, there's storytellers who stand in one place in front of a stand-up microphone and are, and do it beautifully, or they sit on a stool in, you know, in front of a microphone, and they, and they're, you know, you travel around in your mind just like you would with any great storyteller. But sometimes it might just be interesting to be aware of your space. When you're, you know, when you're doing theater, you're very aware that you've got this, this defined space to create the world in. And so it's just, you know, what I'm not saying you have to use all the space on the stage, but you have that option if you want to be aware of it. Things like, I mean, one of the best pieces of advice I ever got from a director, she said, before you walk out on stage, there's four questions you got to ask and answer, and that's, who are you, where are you, why are you here, and why should we care?
Yeah.
And if the storyteller would ask those same questions before they walk out, it's, I mean, it's the same thing. What? Who are you? You know, where are you? Why are you here? And why should we care? That's a legitimate question to ask anybody who's going to get up and say, I want you to listen to me for the next 27 minutes. You know,
yeah.
A great piece of acting advice is always make specific choices. I'll bet you, you do this all the time in your writing workshop, Stephen, or, you know, anytime you, any writer, it's who, somebody said, in general is the enemy of art. In general is the enemy of art. Always, the more specific something is, the more universal it is.
Yeah.
You know, you don't just, you know, it was a nice day. It was, you know, you tell me the day. Tell me the day. And same thing in the stories. I remember there was a Jay O'Callaghan, you know, he's a fabulous storyteller. And he talks about a neighbor who had a dog. The dog was named Bones, and the way he, just the way he says it, Bones, you know immediately the woman and you know the dog. And he quotes the woman saying, Bones, why does one bark, Bones? And that's all he had to tell us, and we know so much because it's very specific. You know, and you think about if he had said, now, if you don't quit yapping, I'm going to blister your butt, you know, you'd have a very different picture of the dog and the woman.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you because you've used something very specific rather than just saying, well, we had a neighbor and she had a dog. So that's something. The whole idea of in theater, you create a backstory for your characters. And I think it's the same thing in storytelling. Even if I'm not going to give you all the whole who shot John from the day they were born, I have to, you know, Barbara McBride-Smith, another storyteller, says, when, if you have a character in your story, you need to know how much change they've got in their pocket.
Hmm.
You know, you really know more about that person than you're telling us, and that richness of is going to fill out that person to the reader or to the listener. This, the whole thing, of course, sounds and words and using your voice and taking care of your voice, that's all stuff that storytellers and actors have in common. There's that whole dreaded M word, memorization. And, Stephen, I remember in class you and Tracy Radosovic did a thing called Rats. Do you remember doing that?
Yes,
it,
I do.
That poem, Rats, and it was these rats in the tower, rats. And the two of you got up, and it was this tandem poem you did. And it, I mean, it, 20 years later, I still remember it. You didn't make
forgot
that up
all
as you went
that
along. You know, and so many storytellers have a thing about, oh, I don't want to memorize it. And there's a difference. Actors get trained to deliver a memorized paragraph that is different from, you know, I'm memorizing this by rote. And I think there's a whole exploration of that idea of memorization that is part of, when I do that workshop, it's part of that discussion. And the best way I can describe it is that when, you know, if some weird impulse takes hold of me, it doesn't happen very often, but I decide, say, to wash my kitchen floor, and I have a bucket of water, and I go outside, and I live on a hill. And so if I take the bucket of water and I dump it down the, you know, the little gully, it sort of meanders and swerves down to the street. And then let's say there's a second bucket of water, and I pour that one down, and it swerves in a similar pattern, but maybe not exactly. By the fifth bucket of water, it has found its best way down the hill. And to me, that's what, quote unquote, the memorized story is. You have told it and worked it and listened to it and listened to the response to it, and the words have found their best way down the hill. And so it's not a matter of now I'm memorizing those words, but it's a matter of I can say this in an artful way that I know has communicated well the last 20 times I told it, so I'm going to use these words, you know, or not. And so there's that whole, I don't want to get into my soapbox on this, but actors understand memorization in a whole different and less scary way than storytellers do, I think.
Good.
Those are some of the kinds of things that, you know, that I talk about in that workshop. And the final point, and I think this is true for storytellers, writers, whatever, is the word entertain comes from the French entretenir, which means to hold between. And I love that image. But that's what entertaining is. You're holding between. There's the teller, the writer, and the reader or listener, and you're that hammock you've created in between is what's holding you together. And I just love that image.
All of those are really great points for anyone who's doing a presentation.
Oh, absolutely.
Whether it's, you know, corporate business, I'm sure you share some of these, you know, techniques with corporate communicators. And the one that might scare them is the memories. But you're really not saying you write a text and then have to commit that to memory. But you're saying you try a few different ways. Maybe that's, you know, with your dog or your, you know,
yeah,
by yourself on your,
yeah,
on a walk or a jog or something, and then you find the one that feels right, and you try to follow that. So yeah, I think it is a little bit different approach, and it maybe isn't so scary as saying, you know, here's this 3-page text that you have to memorize. Instead, let's just tell it a couple of times and find where the water flows. And I like that. That's nice.
Yeah. Some words and phrases just work better. I mean, as, you know, as writers, you know that. I mean, you can put down just, you know, random met. I mean, I know you're always rewriting. And why are you doing that? Because the water hasn't found its best way down the hill yet. And you know, and all, even in storytelling, there may come a time when you tell it and those words aren't working anymore. So then,
yeah,
so then maybe, you know, you can still change it. But I do think, well, again, I love words, and I really respect words, and I want to sort of use the best, most polished ones I can think of. Now, the really fun workshop that I love to do is a corollary, not just between acting and storytelling, but between dancing and storytelling.
Oh, yeah.
And
tell us about that.
I have a workshop. It's called Everything I Really Needed to Know About Storytelling I Learned in Dance Class. And in the class, I teach people how to do a Cajun waltz. We get up and we dance. The first 30 minutes of the workshop is we get up and we dance. And people are looking at me like, what in the world, have you lost your mind? But then, you know, and we change partners and we change who's leading and who's following, and we change the music, all this stuff. And then we sit down and we say, okay, what in the world did this have to do with storytelling? But there's so much that has to do with storytelling. I mean, the whole idea, it's a partnership. It's a partnership, and somebody is leading and somebody is following, and you got to know which role you're in, or it's a big mess. But
yeah,
if you're the leader, then lead. And sometimes you have to lead with more confidence than you feel.
Yeah.
But if that's the role you're in, that's the role you're in. The idea of, you know, you get better by doing it. You know, you can't learn to dance sitting on the sofa. You can't learn to tell stories by just, you know, staying in your office. You got to do it. and it's a physical thing, and you've got to, you know, be able to actually get out there and express it. The whole idea of listen to the music in the room. You know, when you're dancing, if they're playing a waltz and you're doing a jitterbug, it's never going to really quite feel right. And the same way, sometimes you walk in a room. I remember one time being invited to come do a story at it was this big luncheon, ladies' big thing, annual meeting. And right before we started, news came in that one of their, like, founding members had died.
Oh, my goodness.
Boy, the music in that room changed.
Yeah.
You know, and all of a sudden, those cute, funny little stories I was going to tell weren't going to work anymore because the music was different. So, you know, that's a way to – and, again, none of this is anything a storyteller or story performer doesn't already know, but sometimes I feel like if you can use a different metaphor for it, whether that's acting or dancing or, you know, coloring in a coloring book, it
yeah.
just makes you see it in a little bit different way. Something you already know, but it just says, okay, maybe I see it again. And I'd forgotten that. I knew that, but that's a different way to help me remember.
Yeah, that's nice. And, you know, when you dance, it's a give and take, too, I think, where you respond to the other person.
Right. Exactly.
And, you know, and audiences and storytellers create a unique social encounter. And if I get up to tell a story and it's my shtick that I've done at the last previous 100 events,
yeah.
and I do it the exact same way, the audience might be sitting there like, I can tell, that's just your shtick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But instead, yeah. and, you know, as I start, and that's what I hear you saying, Dolores, with the idea of you need to respond. In this case, the music changed, and you needed to, you know, respond to that and to your audience and your listeners. So I tell people, write your stories with your mouth. You know, anytime that you're orally performing or teaching or whatever you want to call it, is don't necessarily write it down beforehand, but instead just speak it out loud, and you will find that, well, in your case, you'll find the route, you know, with the water down
yeah.
down the hill.
Yeah.
And so much of great, I think, speakers that I've heard, storytellers, do respond. When people laugh at a certain time,
mm-hmm.
they maybe milk that.
Mm-hmm.
If people
mm-hmm.
are, you know, maybe not as responsive, maybe take a shortcut and they find a different route down the hill,
right.
but that responsiveness is also a way of respecting your audience and gaining and keeping the trust that you mentioned earlier.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes some stories it's easier to do that than others. That's certainly a place where the if you're doing a personal story, that's a story you wrote and that's about, you know, it's about you. You can take shortcuts. You can adjust. You can say, oh, I'm not going to do that part. I'm going to jump ahead. I'm going to cut this short. You know, if you're doing something that's literary or
oh, yeah, it'd be
harder, a little
to
harder
do.
To do.
Yeah.
There's a lot
yeah,
harder
that's true.
To do. But you do have more flexibility. I know something else that in the dance workshop, the corollary there that I think is really important. In the class, you say, you know, we're going to get up, and now you're all going to be leaders. You're going to be followers, and now, you know, put your left arm around, you know, around the back and the right arm, and they have to touch each other. And people, even people 30, 40, 50 years old, they're like sixth graders, you know. Ooh, I don't want to get cooties.
Yeah.
But when you're telling a story, when you're, again, you've asked somebody to get out of their home and come and sit in that audience and be there with you in that room, that's effectively what you're doing. You are holding out your arms and saying, let me take you in my arms and guide you around this room for the next 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes we forget, is that again, it's that emotional availability that we ask for. And I think sometimes we forget what it is we're asking of people. We're saying, trust me, you know, lean back in my arm and walk backwards, and I'm going to guide us so that you're not going to run into anything. It's not going to, you know, it's not going to be dangerous, and I'm not going to make you look silly. And
oh, go ahead, sorry.
Yeah. No, that's it. I think in dancing it's very clear, and we sense that, oh, that hesitation and that, you know, and that sort of fear, and that's exactly the same thing that we're doing with an audience. And it's so easy to take for granted how much of a commitment we're asking people to make to us.
Yeah, I was going to add.
Great. Yeah,
I was going to add to that the reason so many people. Especially writers that I encounter in my own self, you know, you start from a point of, you know, you want to create this thing and it's all about you, And that's fine when you're just writing and scribbling in notes and stuff like that. But when you want to do that dance and when you want people to participate, you do have to think about them. And, you know, that's one reason why I hate book signings, because they're so dismal, because, you know, people don't care. And, you know, from my standpoint, it's like you're trying to sell people on a book. But I love doing them because of that, because it reminds me, listen, there are people out there and they're busy and, you know, time is money and all those sort of things. And if it helps visualize that, because especially as a writer, you can be in your own little world. You don't have an audience if you're actually just behind a computer screen.
Right.
So
right.
It's right. I love the idea of the dance. That's a fascinating way to illustration. So I love that. I appreciate
yeah.
that.
Great. You know, there's one other thing from the whole dance thing, and I don't think it applies to writers, but it sure applies to storytellers, and that is whether you're dancing or telling stories, wear comfortable shoes.
Yeah.
If you're
feeling
it, nothing's going to go right. Now, you guys, you can kick your shoes off and sit there at the computer, but...
yeah.
Well, that's a good place. We're going to have to wrap up here.
Okay.
But I'm really, I could sit and just listen to your thoughts all day. It was really very informative, and I know our listeners are going to love just listening to you. And we want them also to run out and buy your CDs or go check you out in person whenever you're performing. Where's the best place for people to go to either buy your work already that's been recorded, your performances, or to see you to find out when you're going to be appearing?
Well, the best place to find any of that information is at my website. It's www.storypower, S-T-O-R-Y-P-O-W-E-R, storypower.org. And there's a list of upcoming events, as well as you can buy CDs through PayPal or credit card right there on the site.
All right. Well, we are going to wrap up. For more information about my novel writing intensive retreats that I teach around the country, click to novelwritingintensive.com. And Travis, tell us your website again.
Yeah, it's just my name, TravisThrasher.com. You can reach me there.
Excellent. And for more info about our other guests and to check out our other broadcasts, click to thestoryblender.com. And always remember,
the art of the story is all in the blend.
We'll see you next time.